Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 18, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone is on the Argentina bond case, or cases, decided earlier this week in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to our call two experts today. We're happy to have both of them. We appreciate you joining us today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of about 6 to 10 minutes, then a little bit of back and forth, and then questions from our audience. So please do be ready with your questions at that time. First, we're going to hear from Professor Michael D. Ramsey. He's the Hugh and Hazel Darling Foundation Professor of Law and Director of International and Comparative Law Programs at the University of San Diego School of Law. He'll be followed in his opening remarks by Professor Thomas H. Lee, the Leitner Family Professor of International Law and Director, Graduate and International Studies at Fordham University School of Law. And again, gentlemen, thank you both for being here. With that, Professor Ramsey, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, and thanks to everyone for joining this call, and thanks to the Federal Society for having me to talk about this interesting case or set of cases. I'll give just a real quick background on the how these cases got to the Supreme Court, and then just a quick overview of what happened on Monday. So for those of you who haven't followed these cases, it started back in 2001 when Argentina defaulted on its sovereign bonds. Some of the bondholders agreed to a refinancing, but other bondholders sued Argentina in U.S. court in New York, which Argentina had consented to in the contracts covering the bonds. And on the merits of that case, the bondholders won their breach of contract action against Argentina. Argentina then refused to pay, and the bondholders sought two remedies from the district court. First, they wanted to get discovery of Argentina's worldwide assets so they could identify assets that they could potentially execute on to satisfy the judgment. Secondly, they sought an injunction against Argentina paying the refinanced bonds, that is, the people that had agreed to the refinancing rather than suing, before Argentina paid on the original bonds. The district court gave both of these orders, and the Second Circuit affirmed. Argentina then petitioned separately, two separate petitions, to the Supreme Court, arguing that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act gave it immunity against both of the district court's orders. The Supreme Court granted cert on the discovery order case, and I think probably the reason they did so was because there was a conflicting case out of the Seventh Circuit involving a case against Iran where the Second Circuit had held immunity for the sovereign. The separate case remained on petition, that is the injunction case. So the discovery order case was argued back in April. On Monday, the Supreme Court released its opinion in that case, upholding the district court's order, rejecting Argentina's arguments. It also denied cert on the petition involving the injunction. So it was a double loss for Argentina on Monday. In the opinion that the Supreme Court delivered, it was 7-1. Justice Scalia wrote the opinion. Justice Ginsburg dissented. Justice Sotomayor was recused. In the opinion by Scalia, it closely follows the text of the FSIA. He says that the FSIA provides two immunities. One is from suit, but that one didn't apply because Argentina had waived it, and one from, quote, attachment, arrest, and execution of sovereign assets, which similarly, he said, did not apply. Didn't elaborate there, but I assume that because the discovery order didn't attach, arrest, or execute upon anything, but simply involved disclosure, it didn't fall within that immunity either. He then said, Scalia says, there is no third immunity, and so Argentina loses. And that's the end of the analysis. Scalia acknowledged that there were potential foreign relations implications, as had been argued by Argentina and by the United States government in support of Argentina, but he declined to consider them. He said that that's a matter that should be addressed to Congress, not to the court, and that the court simply applies the text of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. So, in sum, what we had was a very strong textualist read of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which in my assessment is very much in keeping with the way the Supreme Court has approached the act in past cases, cases such as Samatar versus Youssef, which was a couple years ago, another very strong textualist reading. Very much in a classic Scalia style, I think, in the opinion, but he was able to persuade a large majority of the court to go along with a very strict reliance on the text and not getting into the potential policy implications. So I think for a FSIA practitioner standpoint, the message here going forward is that textualist arguments win the day for the FSIA, and that policy arguments need to be hooked to text and not free-floating, as Argentina's sort of were here. As far as post-judgment remedies, again, it's a very strong opinion against the sovereign. It leaves possibly open the fact that something in the federal rules might Federal Rules of Civil Procedure might limit district court's discretion to have too wide-reaching an order, but they don't address that issue because they say Argentina didn't raise it in time. The FSIA, though, doesn't provide any protection, apparently, for sovereigns against discovery orders. Or I think the fair implication, and then this is sort of the final point I'll make and step aside, arguably, from Argentina's perspective, rather than from a Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act practitioner's perspective, from Argentina's perspective, the bigger defeat was not the opinion, but it was the denial of cert in the injunction appeal, because this puts Argentina in a bad spot. If it's not allowed to pay on the refinance debt before it pays on the original debt, then it'll either have to find some way around that, or it'll have to reach some accommodation with the original debt, or it'll be in a position of having to default on its refinance debt, which would be a very bad thing for it. Although the Supreme Court, as always, didn't make any comment on the denial cert, I think that the reasoning of the opinion they released follows on to the injunction case as well. Again, the injunction doesn't involve an attachment, arrest, or execution, which is the statutory language from the FSIA. And that being the case, the FSIA's text simply doesn't provide any protection for the sovereign. That's what the Second Circuit said, and I think the reasoning of the Supreme Court's decision on the discovery order makes that that view seem quite sound as well. So I will stop there, but I'm happy to entertain questions down the road.
Professor Lee, go right ahead with your opening remarks.
So thanks, Dean, and Federal Society, and Mike. There's very little I disagree with Mike on, Professor Ramsey on, about I'm just going to bring 5 points, and some of them are going to be of interest to the practitioners as practice. Some of them are sort of bigger points about where jurisprudence in this area seems to be heading. One point is it's an incredibly textualist opinion, and I think that Professor Ramsey is correct that basically this seems to be the direction in which Supreme Court opinions on foreign sovereign immunity seem to be headed. There was an opinion called Samatar a couple years ago, that made the same kind of very textual analysis of the FSIA. And this statute, and this case, obviously has the same approach to the statute. On that point, I just wanted to say, you know, Scalia is a master textualist, but I didn't find his analysis altogether persuasive on a key point, and that is basically the way the statute is written. It says in 1609, you're immune from execution except as provided in the chapter in the rest of the statute. In 1610 says, shall not be immune from attachment and execution aid of execution or execution with respect to commercial activity. And, you know, if you think about it logically, it doesn't necessarily mean that the crucial question is with regards to who gets to determine whether or not something is commercial or non-commercial. And basically this opinion says essentially the district court does rather than Argentina. And I just wanted to point out that logically, if you put those two sections of the statute together, it's not absolutely clear that the question of who determines what's commercial or non-commercial is actually addressed by the statute, right? And I think that there's a little bit of looseness in the technical analysis of that provision. Now, that being said, the bigger point, over and over again in the opinion, Scalia says that the FSIA, the statute, is supposed to be the comprehensive statement on foreign sovereign immunity. And I think that sort of overstates the case. I mean, that's where the analysis seems to have been heading. But from a more historical standpoint, I don't think it's necessarily clear that when the statute was enacted, it was supposed to be sort of the statement that resolves all issues related to these kinds of foreign sovereign immunity questions, especially when they are so different from what was expected in the 70s, such as this case. And one sort of historical back note to that, I mean, in my own work, I've talked about how even though the current wisdom is that foreign sovereign immunity, and I'm quoting from the opinion, isn't always has been a matter of grace and comedy on the part of the United States, not a restriction imposed by the Constitution. It's pretty clear if you look at early constitutional materials debates that, in fact, many people thought, including Supreme Court justices, that foreign sovereign immunity was a constitutional issue. In fact, it was brought up a lot as a reason for saying state sovereign immunity was constitutional, and the argument we saw over and over again in the early days of the Republic was certainly the states have as much as the foreign sovereigns do, and they're constitutionally immune, right? So the modern understanding is the modern understanding, but it wasn't always the case, and I think that this presumption of textual with regards to the statute is somewhat nouveau rather than something that's always been there on this particular issue. The second point I wanted to make about the statute is we don't see anything about the presumption against extraterritorial effect, which we'd seen in discussions of another statute, the Alien Tort Statute, in the human rights context. And I think that there's a little bit of tension there because, you know, you have a U.S. law, and the question is there a presumption against extraterritorial effect of a U.S. law, whether it's the Alien Tort Statute or the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, that allows a plaintiff to seek discovery in aid of execution of a judgment? And Scalia's opinion essentially says no. And he says, well, you know, we're talking about discovery to find out where their property is, period. And so it makes logical sense to do that. But it's not altogether clear to me that if you're serious about the presumption of extraterritorial effect, you can't sort of do a little bit more thinking about that than there is in that opinion. So that's my second point. And then the broader points, and these were points that were raised by the United States brief. Certainly, there's a big concern about reciprocity. The U.S. is involved in litigation in other countries. What if someone orders discovery on U.S. assets in some other national court, or as the nitty-gritty of these cases involve, it usually involves former U.S. officials, like, say, Don Rumsfeld or something, and has a brokerage account with Barclays or something, and they walk in and say, have the same kind of discovery request. And I think that is, in my mind, a legitimate concern. I mean, the reality is that very few other jurisdictions have discovery as robust as the United States, and those that might, and also happen to be major financial centers, are friends of ours, and so it probably won't be a big issue, but certainly in theory and down the line, it could be a dangerous precedent to say that basically a national court in a country that is a major financial center has the power to order broad discovery with regards to sovereign property and whether it's commercial or not commercial. So I think that's pretty much all I wanted to say.
All right. Very good. Thank you both again. Professor Ramsey, you want to augment your opening remarks, respond in any way?
Sure. I'll say just a couple of things. And I think there are strong points of disagreement between myself and Professor Lee, but let me pick up on a couple things that he said that I may agree with him in a way that he doesn't necessarily want to be agreed with, but I'll see what I can do with that. On the extraterritorial effect, which I think is a real interesting point, I think that Scalia's response on that, and I would agree, is that there isn't any question at all about the extraterritorial effect of the FSIA, because the conclusion in the opinion is that the FSIA simply doesn't apply. It's not a question about the FSIA allowing this discovery, but rather it's that the FSIA doesn't prohibit the discovery. That's the conclusion that the court reaches. That raises the question then that I alluded to briefly in my opening remarks, but just to clarify, raises the question of, well, what does allow this discovery? And then the answer is, what allows the discovery is Federal Rule Civil Procedure 69, which allows the district court to make orders in support of post-judgment remedies. But then I think the question that Professor Lee poses is an interesting one, does Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, at least this is the way I would pose the question that he's posing, is does Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 69 have extraterritorial effect? That it does it allow allow the district court to make extraterritorial orders? This issue came up in the oral argument on the Argentina case, but it doesn't make an appearance in the opinion. Because they just sort of say the 69 issue wasn't raised. But I think it's an interesting question, and it might be a place to go for foreign sovereigns in the future trying to resist broad discovery orders, is to make more out of Federal Civil Procedure 69 and less out of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. So that's my response on the extraterritorial effect. On the policy and the reciprocity side of this, I'm inclined to agree that there are significant policy issues and that there are significant policy arguments, both on the discovery point and also, I think, perhaps arguably even more so, on the injunction. Because if you actually consider what happened, is that here we have a district court in the United States ordering a foreign sovereign to not do certain things with its sovereign assets, that is, repay the refinance bonds. And I think that's a pretty bold step. But I think that, in fact, what that does is it sort of reinforces the extent to which the Supreme Court is taking a very strong textualist line and saying, well, we don't deny that these are significant policies, but if this is a problem, then it's for Congress to take care of. And that then goes to the other point that Professor Lee made at the opening about how the Supreme Court is seeing, for better or for worse, the FSIA as being really a comprehensive matter here, and then rightly or wrongly. And then so if that's right, then it follows that what needs to happen if there's a policy problem here is for Congress to fix it. And I think it's quite right that isn't the way it was thought about in the old days. And in particular, in the old days, it was thought that that the executive branch had some significant role here. And the executive branch's role here in this case was reduced to, well, it's nicely raised these issues, but we're really not interested. Which is, I think, a significant rejection of an executive role. So, after this, as I think indeed, and as Samantar indicated a couple years ago, it really comes down to the statute for better or for worse. I happen to think that it's good to have the statute be sort of the comprehensive statement and let Congress fix it if it feels like it. But I certainly understand that people might feel there were some policy considerations got slighted here.
Professor Lee, you want to take a minute, or should we turn to the audience?
Yeah, so the only response is basically, I feel that, and I think Ginsburg sort of overplayed her hand in the dissent, but to some extent, there are statutes that are truly comprehensive or should be construed as comprehensive, and then there are some statutes, and I'm not saying that this is sort of like a 1933 Securities Act or the 34 Act. I mean, I'm not saying that judicial gloss should play that much of a role here. I just feel that with regards to this particular issue, particularly, and I heard Mike to agree with me, particularly if you're an originalist and if you believe as an originalist matter that there is a constitutional scope to what Congress could do, right, which as I said is completely contrary to the conventional wisdom, then it seems to me that, well, why isn't this one where we are much more logical about the ambiguity and there is some more gap-filling role for the judicial power, right? Particularly if you think if you're not originalist, then it doesn't matter for you. But if you think as an original matter, people seriously thought that there was some constitutional limitation to what Congress could do with the sovereign immunity of foreign countries. It makes sense because the United States was a militarily weak power and they were afraid of offending other states by what was happening in national courts. So, and on Rule 69, in some sense, I think that maybe the way to do it is to put it into the rule. I mean, certainly substantively, it's a better fit. I think that there is, however, and Ginsburg gets at this somewhat in her opinion. I mean, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act really is a statute enacted to deal with the business of the national courts within the United States, right? And so it's hard to point to a specific textual anchor, but I don't think it's unreasonable to say that maybe we should be worried about sort of allowing a construction of a rule that would seem to allow a national court to inquire into the Argentina consulate's accounts in Senegal or wherever, right? So in any event.
All right, well, let's check in with the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our first caller, let me announce our schedule. Upcoming tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time, we'll be hosting a telephone conference call with John Fund and Hans von Spakovsky talking about their new book, Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. But today, of course, we're talking about the Argentina bond case. Our lines are wide open right now. We don't have any caller questions. If you'd like to join the conversation, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see if folks ring in, let me ask about some of the countervailing policy positions that I had been reading about. First, I understand that Argentina waived its sovereignty when it issued the bonds, that it subsequently became the subject of the litigation, and that had Argentina sort of been able to do a mulligan on the bond waiver, it would have made future attempted waivers of sovereignty by other developing countries less meaningful, therefore make it much more difficult for them to issue sovereign debt. Is that part of the calculation here? Is that all correct? Have I got that right?
Yes and no, I guess. Maybe this is Mike Ramsey speaking. I think the way I'd respond to that is it's true on Argentina's behalf that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act has two immunities. It has an immunity from suit, and then it has an immunity from execution. And there isn't any doubt that Argentina waived its immunity from suit, and Argentina didn't deny that. It did also waive its immunity from execution, but in the United States, although this is not necessarily true internationally, the immunity from execution on non-commercial assets is non-waivable under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. I'm not sure if I had too many double negatives in there, but the short of it is that Argentina retains its immunity from execution with respect to its non-commercial assets. And again, I don't think there's any question about that either. The question is whether Argentina has to disclose all of its assets. And the concern, and there is a very good policy concern on this side, I think, if Argentina doesn't have to disclose all its assets, or as Professor Lee puts it, if Argentina gets to decide which of its assets are commercial and which are not, and then disclose the commercial ones, then that may give Argentina an unfair advantage in concealing its assets, or at least taking a very aggressive position about what's non-commercial. And then that, in turn, was felt to create a situation where sovereigns might be able to avoid any real remedies in the case of defaulted debt or indeed any sort of sovereign contracts, if they could avoid disclosing their assets. So I think that's really the problem. It's not so much about taking back their immunity from suit, but rather making that immunity, that waiver of immunity from suit, sort of irrelevant, in the sense that if they can hide their assets, then it doesn't do you any good to be able to sue them. I'm not sure if that made sense or not, but I think it does centrally go back to the question of whether you're going to have Argentina disclose all its assets and then the district court decide which are commercial and subject to execution and which aren't, or if you're going to let Argentina decide which are commercial and which are not. And my guess is in the latter case that not that many are going to end up being commercial.
Right, and had that been allowed to happen, then it would have been more difficult, I take it, for other sovereigns to get credit on the open market, because the holders of debt there would I mean, that their power is somewhat eroded by a decision that goes contrary to this decision. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Good. Professor Lee, anything on this point before we turn to the audience?
No, I agree with Mike. I think a lot of the analysis confuses those two issues, but 1609, which is the provision of the Title 28, the FSIA, that talks about execution immunity, I mean, there's no waiver exception there. So basically, the way I sort of explain it to my students is sovereign immunity, when you waive it, you sort of waive the affirmative defense to liability. But if you think about, let's say, a country's only property in a jurisdiction is its embassy or whatever, you're not saying that just by virtue of the fact that you're liable on a claim that basically you've also waived the ability of the judgment, or you've sort of agreed to the judgment creditor taking I guess the property would be leased, but whatever is sovereign property in the country, right? So that's, they're not the same issue.
Right. All right. Let's take a question from our callers.
I have a question for Professor Ramsey. He mentioned that at the same time the court handed down its decision, it also denied cert in a related case that many people think of as a bigger one, despite the fact that Argentina had widespread amicus support in the financial community as well as by a number of foreign countries. And if you're willing to read the tea leaves, I'd be interested in your views as to why they did not grant review. Was it that they thought that Tuesday's decision kind of answered the questions under the FSIA, or is it more that perhaps they really didn't want to get involved in a dispute when a foreign country had basically said it would ignore a decision that went against them?
Yeah, that's a great question, and you know, I have no idea, so I'm just speculating here. But my speculation is that it is the former. That is, that they thought that the decision that they rendered on the discovery issue was dispositive of the issue that they of the question on the injunction, because again, just as there's no immunity from discovery orders, at least in the text of the FSIA, in so many words, there's also no immunity from injunctions. The immunity only runs against attachment, arrest, and execution, which isn't implicated in the injunction case, at least if you read everything involved literally. So as a result, my guess is that they thought that there wasn't any point in taking the case because they would reach the same conclusion, but especially given where we are in the Supreme Court cycle, taking the case now would mean you wouldn't see a decision until sometime next spring. There wasn't any point in taking the case just to affirm the Second Circuit. That's my speculation. There was some question about whether Argentina's open reluctance, shall we say, to follow legitimate orders of the district court in terms of on that is the judgment on paying the judgment on the merits would influence the court. I don't know whether it would or not. I think that if they thought it was a important issue, they would take it regardless. But I think again, this is just speculation. But my answer to the best I can speculate is that they thought that the opinion they gave in the discovery order issue case was dispositive as well of the injunction.
Professor Lee, do you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that basically, you know, they knew that they had taken one of the cases. They knew how it was going to come out, right? And there was a split on that issue. The two cases, they're different issues, but they're certainly linked from a practical standpoint. And if you take it, I mean, you could essentially have two ways to dispose of the case. You can affirm, which as Mike said, might sort of increase the settlement value, but it doesn't really change anything. Or you could knock it down, which renders this opinion that they handed down last Monday essentially moot, because if Argentina can go ahead and pay its the ones who restructured, then you know the case essentially goes away. So I sort of look at it, and if you put yourself in the shoes of the law clerks that are writing the memos and the justices thinking it, I mean, it's just not a compelling case to grant and sort of have a yes or no decision. It's actually a nicer solution to just deny it and punt on it in the way they did.
It is also true, as Professor Lee says, that there wasn't any split on this issue from the lower courts. As far as I know, this is the first time this has happened on the injunction point, whereas there was a split on the discovery order case, so they kind of had to take the discovery order case. And so, again, the lack of split might just be enough, although, as the questioner said, there were foreign governments and then the U.S. government intervening, getting involved as amicus, so the international significance of the case, I think, was quite high, and sometimes you see the court taking things just on that basis, even without a split, but again, that's why I sort of go back to they kind of thought the Second Circuit got it right, so there was no need to get involved.
And I don't know, I mean, do you know, Mike, what the Solicitor General recommended?
On the injunction case, the Solicitor General didn't get a chance to make a recommendation. Indeed, that was one of the interesting things, is that they denied it straight up instead of calling for the views of the Solicitor General, which would have been the
intermediate option. Yeah,
would have been the intermediate option, but again, it would have put the case way over because you wouldn't have gotten a response from the Solicitor General until sometime at best in the fall, and so they did not call for the Solicitor General's opinion. Now, the United States government, however, had supported Argentina, I believe, at the Second Circuit level. So I think they also had a pretty good idea what the Solicitor General would say.
And do we know procedurally what happens next going forward?
I suppose that the banks, the Argentine banks to which the discovery orders were actually directed, are going to have to come up with their response to the discovery orders and actually disclose the location of assets, unless Argentina can come up with a new argument. And I think it might be the case, but here I'm now I'm not sufficiently familiar with the details of the case of the district court to know whether it's open to Argentina to go back and argue that Rule 69 ought to limit the scope of the order. But otherwise, the banks will have to start making the disclosures, I would think. On the injunction, what I have read, but this is only just from reading newspaper accounts, is that that the next payment to the bondholders is due at the end of the month, and so Argentina needs to do something one way or the other. They'll either find some way to settle or at least postpone that. That issue, or else they would have to default, or I suppose violate the injunction.
Those are the non holdout bondholders who accepted the negotiated settlement earlier.
Yes,
right.
Yes. Right. I mean they could just go ahead and pay them only, right? And then NML would go to the court and presumably seek contempt or whatever, another judicial order.
Right, and in paying them, they'd be violating the injunction, right?
Yeah.
Right. There actually might be some question as to how they would pay them, though, because might not process the payment because one might regard the U.S. bank as being in violation of the injunction.
Right.
Interesting. We've got one question pending at this point. If you'd like to join the conversation from our audience, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, and good afternoon. I was hoping you guys could speak about the ramifications that the interpretation of the pari passu clause has been given in the NML case.
This is Mike Ramsey. I'm not sure that I'm fully qualified to speak on that, but that won't prevent me from giving it a shot. What the question's referring to is the pari passu or equal treatment clause in the original bonds. That's what the injunction hangs on or hinges on. In the original bonds, there's a clause that says the bonds have to be treated equally with subsequent debt, and then what the district court concluded, as I understand it, is that under New York law, what that means is that Argentina can't refinance the bonds and then pay the new bondholders on the refinance bonds more favorably than the old bondholders who didn't refinance. That's the equal treatment, right? You have to treat the original bondholders the same way that you treat the new bondholders. That's what the district court held, and then the injunction prohibits Argentina from, in fact, doing that, which is what Argentina would very much like to do. Argentina had also argued that this interpretation of the pari passu clause, the equal treatment clause, was incorrect, and I don't really have an opinion about that, except to say that I can't imagine the Supreme Court ever getting involved in that. I'm not sure why Argentina even made that argument in their petition, because that's a question of state law, not something the Supreme Court's going to care about. But as to the financial implications of it, my understanding is that Argentina's argument is that this would make refinancings very difficult, if this is what the clause means, because you basically couldn't do them without 100% approval of the existing bondholders. Which I guess my reaction to that is, I thought that's what the pari passu clause was supposed to do, was to prevent refinancings without approval of 100% of the bondholders. And if you wanted to have a refinancing without the consent of 100% of the bondholders, you had a clause in the contract, which is sometimes called a collective action clause, which says that basically you can do a refinancing with the approval of two-thirds of the bondholders or three-quarters of the bondholders, something like that. And the dissenters, it's tough luck for the dissenters. There is no such clause in these Argentine bonds. Argentina might want to put that clause in their bonds in the future, I guess, is my opinion, is that you'll maybe see, when you ask about the implications of the holding, my guess is that you will see more clauses like this in future sovereign refinancings. But this is all, let me emphasize, very much off the top of my head. I'm something of a Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act lawyer, but I am not a bond lawyer at all. So I offer these thoughts very tentatively.
Professor Lee.
So I'm doubly tentative, but I would imagine sovereign bond is, because this was a pari passu clause from it was a prior generation, and so I would imagine you could lawyer around this. One possibility is the collective action type clause where you have a supermajority type rule that, like Mike indicated. I'd imagine another way you could lawyer around it is, the NML got these on the secondary market. I think maybe you could sort of try to figure out some way to write into a contract a way to take them out of the equation, so to speak, right? Because in a way, from an equity perspective, they never paid full dollar on the dollar anyway. So the equity arguments aren't quite as persuasive. So I'd imagine there are probably ways to lawyer around it. But we're talking about the interpretation of a clause from an earlier generation, and I think that I'm not a bond lawyer either, but there's nothing that screams out that what the Second Circuit did was wrong.
Once again, if you have a question for our experts, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, and then our phone lines are open. Let's go to our next caller.
Did any foreign countries file friend of the court briefs in opposition to Argentina? It would seem that I think it came up during the previous commentary that a number of foreign nations might well have an interest in having waiver clauses judged to be enforceable, and it would seem for that reason they might well have an interest in opposing Argentina on this case. But if I recall correctly, the majority and maybe all of the foreign country amicus briefs came in support of Argentina.
Yeah, I don't think any. I mean, it would logically be a creditor, net creditor nation, and I didn't look at the amicus list very carefully, but I don't think anyone took that position. Mike, I don't know if you know for sure.
I believe that. I believe the questioner is correct. I believe that the answer is there were no foreign sovereigns on the other side, to the best of my knowledge. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, Tom, you say the creditor nation, but I guess the theory of the policy in support of the bondholders is that a debtor nation, that a prospective debtor nation actually wants the contract to be enforced, because then in the future, sovereign debt will be cheaper. That is, that if bondholders know that they'll that they have remedies, then they won't demand as high an interest rate. Argentina's debt has pretty high interest these days, and would probably be even higher if you think there's no creditor's remedy. So I think sort of the economics policy kind of runs that way, but I'm also sort of think that debtors don't really think that way. So I guess I'm not really surprised that there wasn't any amicus on the other side.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're hearing about that, let me ask Professor Ramsey or Professor Lee if you were surprised by not the outcome but the vote count. It was pretty lopsided. I know this was a sort of highly anticipated decision. I don't know if people were predicting a closer division of justices as opposed to the 7-1 that ended up winning the day.
Yeah, this is Thomas Lee. I thought it might be 6-2. I thought that Kagan might be with Ginsburg. I was pretty sure of the result. Both Kagan and Ginsburg are legal process. They take more of a legal process view of statutes in general, and particularly in this area than Scalia would. And so I was a bit surprised that it was as lopsided as it was. But at the same time, a lot of the actual practical effect will depend on Rule 69 and the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure. So the result itself isn't that surprising. But I did think that maybe it would be a little bit more even rather than 7-1.
I had sort of a similar view as Mike Ramsey. I had a similar view. I think the thing that sort of pushed against that, I think, is that the court has been very textualist on cases like on FSIA cases and related statutes in recent times. For example, the Samantar case that we both mentioned, which I believe was unanimous, right?
That's right.
They seem to have kind of got themselves in a way of thinking about this that's that carries along this result, assuming that you think that the answer on the text itself is, as I do, is pretty clear. Just the question is then whether you want to use some policy and foreign relations concerns to talk about the purpose of the spirit of the statute, and they haven't shown much inclination to do that in these sorts of cases in the past, which is in the recent past, which I think is a really interesting development, because if you go back further, you will, I think, see more concern at the court for actually thinking about policy implications. But here you're really talking about this is what the statute says, and we're done. Of course, Scalia wrote the opinion, so that's what you can expect, but he gets the 7 votes here, and I think that's significant.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'd sort of, the footnote to that I'd add is Samantar, I felt that the textual question was much more explicit and clear, right? I mean, the question was whether or not, I forget what the exact language was, but the statute talks about instrumentality, and it seemed to me that the interpretive question was much more precisely addressed than this one, because, as I said, there's this sort of gap between the way the non-waivable execution immunity is set forth in 1609, and then the clawback is in 1610 for commercial. So it doesn't really answer the question of whether Argentina gets to decide what's commercial or non-commercial, or whether a U.S. federal judge does, right? And so I felt that there was a bit more wiggle room in the joints on this question, but I think I do agree that the court seems to want to put everything into a very textualist understanding of this statute when it comes to foreign sovereign immunity issues.
Yeah, and okay. there in Samantar, the textual argument may have seemed clear at least after they got done with the opinion, but certainly, as you know, there were plenty of court of appeals cases. The weight of the court of appeals was actually the other way in Samantar, and not that that's that rejects your textual conclusion, but the weight, I think, on a policy ground was the other way, and the Supreme Court was having none of it, and I think that's sort of what was going on here as well.
Well, gentlemen, we don't have any questions remaining amongst our audience members. Let me give each of you just a chance to make a final express a final thought here, and let's go in reverse order. Professor Lee, you want to offer up a final remark here?
Yeah, so two remarks, actually. One, from a practical standpoint, if any of you are going to be litigating FSIA issues, it seems to me that your number one argument will be to make a finely crafted textual argument, period. The bigger point, and this is sort of something that is the cause of my concern, I'm very skeptical. In the old days, when you had a sovereign debt crisis, you didn't have the prospect of a remedy in a national court. You had political remedies. You could go to your government, and in the late 19th century, they would actually send gunboats at some point and shoot at the guys until they paid. But I think that in a way, we sort of are moving in the opposite direction of having the national, sort of feeling that this is common, letting the common litigation motif prevail over the fact that what's going on here is national courts intervening in sort of big investor state dispute resolution that should be handled in a more political manner. And so that's sort of the big point I want to make.
Professor Ramsey, final thought.
Well, I'll offer two quick ones. The first is in response to what Professor Lee just said. I think that's right. But I think it's worth adding that foreign sovereigns can easily avoid all this by simply not consenting to suit and not making payments through the United States, and so then they can take themselves back out of this as long as the courts are very clear about what the FSIA requires and doesn't require. They should be able to take themselves out of the United States finance if they want. Of course, that'll come with quite a bit of cost in terms of how their debt is valued. But the last point I want to make is going forward is whether this case suggests sort of a wider point about foreign relations law, that whether this is yet another in the pattern that I think at least some people who have studied this area have come to see of first of all a more legalistic or textualist, if you will, approach, not just the FSIA, but also perhaps to other statutes and even constitutional issues in this area, and also whether it reflects a diminishing influence of the executive branch, because this is another case in which the executive branch made a very strong argument and was not able to pick up much of any support from the court. So is there a declining influence of the executive branch in foreign affairs issues, not just in the FSIA, which there certainly is, but perhaps less deference to the executive more broadly? I think that's something to watch for as the court goes forward in foreign affairs cases.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, let me thank you both, Professors Ramsey and Lee. I certainly appreciate you joining us, especially on such short notice, this case having been decided just on Monday. To our audience, a reminder of our next scheduled teleforum conference call tomorrow at 12 noon, that's Eastern Time, when we'll be talking with co-authors John Fund and Hans von Spakovsky about their new book, Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. But until that next teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.